I don't know why, but just skip me, that 83rd Psalm that we just looked at in our last session, that lists the 10 confederate nations. Those are the 10 nations that are going to confederate at the in the tribulation period. And those, you don't have to guess and try to figure out if they're, like I said, China or Canada or Australia or New Guinea, but they're actually listed for you in the Bible. Well, when we come here to the issue of God's Jehovah name, Moses is the central character in which this is actually given. And we come down and we're going to break into Exodus in chapter 3 here, but there's some great wealth of information sitting in chapters 1 and 2 that has to do with really not just the narrative of how Moses was born and hid in the bulrushes and everything, but it's very important that you understand and appreciate that when Israel comes out of Egypt, there was a Pharaoh who was on friendly terms, so to speak, not friendly in the, maybe not the best way to use it, but that was on more of an agreeable position than what came along after this Pharaoh who died, and then the next Pharaoh came in who the Bible says didn't know Joseph. And so you've got the children of Israel now going down into Egypt for 400 years, and it's coming down on the time schedule down to the time where God is going to begin delivering. But I want you to remember that time figure. 400 years that Israel goes into Egyptian slavery. That is a long period of time, no matter what calendar you're going by. That's a long, long time. To not hear from God, to not hear much about God. There's no miracles going on. God's not talking to anybody. It's really a span of four centuries, and we're just barely over halfway on that point in our nation's own history. So that's a long period of time for them to be down there. They grow extensively while they're down there, but there's an awful lot of comfortability of being in that situation. And the alternative oftentimes with the nation of Israel looks far more bleak than if they were back down there in Egypt, where they had learned how to get along in that environment and ate pretty well and they got by okay, and yeah, they were in slavery and everything, but at least they were eating and they had food and water and shelter and some of these kinds of things, and there was some satisfaction with all of that. When we come to Exodus chapter 3, the parents of Moses actually understood that, and we know this later on in the book of Hebrews, they understood there was something very significant about this boy. And there was an attempt to try to kill all of these male children in Israel by the Pharaoh. And so the women were hiding the male children, and Moses was one of those. But Moses grows up, and another significant thing that happens in the opening chapters here is that the issue of when Moses kills the Egyptian. Now, Moses was actually raised by the Egyptians. He grows up in Pharaoh's house. He's one of the main figures in the governmental structure of Egypt. But at one point he sees, when he begins to recognize and realize that he's a Hebrew by birth, he sees an Egyptian nearly killing a Hebrew slave. Moses goes to the Egyptian and basically with his bare hands breaks his neck, kills him, and then he tries to bury him. This is one thing Moses was not a genius at. He was not a very good undertaker or grave digger, because he must have left a toe sticking out or something, but they found the body. And this gets really misinterpreted by most folks. God intended that event to be a particular signal to the nation of Israel about who Moses was. I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. But let's just break into the context here. After that takes place, Moses is going to actually flee because of that incident. He feels that he's a murderer, so he's going to run away. And he runs away, and he runs out and spends 40 years, finds himself a wife, starts having some children, caring for sheep and all this kind of thing. And in a lot of ways that I think people don't realize, Moses has some real problems with God by the time this chapter breaks open. So let's look at the beginning of the chapter 3. It says, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb." That's what will be Sinai. "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord," all caps, when Jehovah, "saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said," this is God said, "draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover," he said, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Now let's stop right there. Most people who picture this in TV and movies just kind of show Moses, you know, that this was like he's this holy event. I don't believe that's what's going on here at all. Well, it's obviously a holy place because God says it is. But I think Moses' attitude is largely misunderstood. If my understanding's correct, what's happening here is actually a mild rebuke or a reproof of Moses by God. And there's several things that tell me that. Remember, he had killed this Egyptian, and one of the things that was supposed to be typified by that was that Moses was to be viewed and seen by Israel as, that's him. That's our deliverer. He's the one who's going to deliver us from this Egyptian bondage and get us back up to the land that was promised to us, to our father Abraham and to his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob. And Moses was to be looked at. And Moses completely blew that, and so did the nation of Israel. And by the information contained in the time schedule of Genesis chapter 15, really, Moses leaving the whole thing, dropping it all, and taking off, I don't think was at all right. He actually didn't understand that time schedule that was setting back in Genesis 15, that the 400 years had not quite been accomplished just yet. And therefore, that fulfillment of that time hadn't exactly taken place yet, but it was just about to. And these incidents that took place in his life were indicators of that. His parents, I think, knew that. Moses, by the way, when he gets out here and marries Jethro's daughter and everything, he starts having kids. All right. Now Moses is a Hebrew. He knows he's an Israelite. And one of the things that was given to the nation of Israel, one of the big tells that this nation was to be separate and distinct from all other nations of the world, was what? What was the major signifier of that? Circumcision. Moses didn't circumcise his sons. That's another reason why I'm sure that Moses was in some kind of rebellion here. He was not exactly tracking with God at all. And he needed to be reproved by this, by God. And that's what I think is beginning to happen here in chapter 3. He had come along and started his life and kind of gotten away from all of these concepts and things, and he hadn't even circumcised his children up to this point, his two sons. And really, I think Moses had let God down, so to speak. And he'd become disheartened and disenchanted a little bit. He's despondent over the way things were going with Israel, and kind of wanted to wash his hands of it and get away from it all. So the burning bush incident, my understanding, really is a mild reproof of God to Moses, to get him back into the position God wanted him in, to be able to utilize him as the deliverer he intended for him to be. And and as I said, if you have time, read through Exodus chapters 1 and 2 and take a look at what Moses' parents understood about the time schedule. They understood that that time schedule was in operation. They understood it in a rightful manner. And they understood that this son of mine is a proper child, as the writer of Hebrews will talk about, and being interpreted in that in the Greek language, he was a city child. The city that Abraham looked for, whose builder and maker was God, is going to be vested in this boy of ours, this son of ours. And as Stephen said, he was exceeding fair. Well, every parent thinks their kids are exceeding fair and proper children at some point until they grow up and prove otherwise. But there's with them that's something very unique and particular to Moses. They knew that this was the one. They had a lot of things that they really understood and appreciated. But, like I said, Stephen brings that out in Acts 7. We've looked at that. We're not going to look at it now. And in Hebrews 11, the writer of Hebrews understood this as well. Another thing that indicates to me that this is a reproof is in the next verse. Look at verse 7. It says, "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows." Now stop right there for a moment. Notice the way he says that. He doesn't come along and say, "I have seen the." He says, "I have surely seen this." It's almost like you get the idea that you're breaking in on a conversation where there's a little bit of an argument going on, and he goes. It's almost like Moses is his attitude is such that, well, it's been 400 years. We've been in this, languishing in this position all the time. We're no closer to getting back to that land and getting that promise that was made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob than we were 400 years ago. God has turned his hearing aids down or off. He's just gone blind to the whole situation. And whether it was verbalized or not, when God comes along and reproves Moses, he says, "I have surely seen it." And I like the way that he uses the word "surely." You know, it's almost like Moses thought God hadn't seen it. "I've surely seen this." In fact, that's one of the significant things in Moses' mind. So much time has gone by. Maybe God hadn't seen it, or maybe God had turned away from all that he had said back there to Abram. Maybe it really didn't mean anything. So in verse 7, you got Moses thinking that those things that he said to Abraham, Isaac, and those are never going to come to pass. And God reproves him, "I've surely seen this." So he's confronted with that issue, and now he's going to get a commission, actually, to go back into the land of Egypt. And God's going to send him back there and to begin to function as the plan and purpose of God was to have him function in as Israel's deliverer at this time. And he's going to go back there into Egypt, and he's going to make an announcement to the children of Israel of God's readiness now to deliver them. So look at verse 8. He says, "And I am come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and a large, and unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites." They're up there and they're powerful. They're all in their strength now. And the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. "Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh." Here's his commission. "That thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." And Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And he said, "Certainly I will be with thee. And this shall be a token unto thee, that I have sent thee, when thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain." Now, there's a lot of information that we just covered there, but let's just note a couple of things. In that context, you have two big issues coming out. You have an issue of time being an issue. And you have the issue of God now hearing their cry, and all of these this time that's gone by. And Moses understands that there's been centuries of time go by. And that is an issue here. But notice the choice of words that God uses in verse 12. Notice in verse 12 he says, and he said, certainly I will be with thee. And this token and so forth. But he says, certainly. You also have the issue of time, and you've got God talking about a certainty issue. In other words, time isn't a problem with me, and what I said, I certainly will do it. It's what we know as the certainty of His counsel. When God says He's going to do something, He's going to do it. And time is not an issue with God. It never has been. And so, it's just amazing that what you get as you go through this section is the dropping of terms that start thoughts happening in Moses' mind, and those thoughts start generating a particular track of thinking that God is taking him down until he now can confront him with an issue that stems from Moses' own inabilities to be able to articulate what God wants to be said. And so you come on down and really have issues there in verses 8 through 12 where all these questions that Moses brings up, who am I? And you have these questions. It just underscores that Moses is highly skeptical. And skepticism is something that is a very bad thing to get into with God when it comes to either his ability to do something, or the certainty of his counsel to do something, or when and if he'll ever do something. But Moses starts bringing these questions out that just sets on display his own skepticism. He's very skeptical about all of this at this point. That's why I say this is a rebuke against that skepticism that's developed in his thinking. And all that skepticism is dealt with by God. And really, it's nothing but a bunch of fleshly thinking on Moses' part. And Moses gets straightened out on that. But it takes a little bit of time. Look at verse 13. And Moses said unto God, behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, the God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and when they say unto me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? Again, it's a question that comes out of Moses' skepticism. And he's actually thinking along with the same kind of, and thinking about the skepticism that's rooted in the very people of Israel themselves. And he begins thinking about how he was originally rebuffed by them. When he killed the Egyptians, he was rebuffed by the Israelites. This guy's nothing but a murderer. He's a bad guy. We don't want this. He didn't have a very good reputation after killing that Egyptian. They didn't respond very well or right to that at all, by saying, look, there's our deliverer. He did some kind of special forces thing on that Egyptian. That's our man right there. That's the guy who's going to deliver us. No, they rebuffed him. And Moses is still sore about all that. And he's responding with that same kind of skeptical mind and mindset. And his own skepticism about the time issue is in his mind, and the certainty of God doing what he said he was going to do. Well, all of that was just exactly what was going through the minds of the rest of the children of Israel as well. They were that's a reflection on their thinking as well. So God comes along and addresses that in verses 14 and verse 15. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. Those are all capital letters there if you have your King James Bible. I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you. And then that passage we just read earlier, and God said moreover to Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God, your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. So it's not just a name, it's a memorial unto all generations. Well, I think we can get through this in pretty short order this morning. What you have, of course, in the name Lord, as you had it there in all caps, like in verse 7, And we've had it throughout this section, verse 4 and so forth. That's that Jehovah name, YHWH, Jehovah. Now what God is going to do, He's going to take that Jehovah name and He's going to actually give that name, that four-letter name, a verbal expression of how it can be expressed in a verbal form. And to do that, he has two different ways or forms in which it's going to be done. And this is something that I've learned really just recently, why He does this in two ways. I am that I am, and then I am. Now, I know I've taught this before, but there's another important reason kind of behind the scenes of why we get two of these. We'll talk about the obvious reasons first. God said unto Moses, I am that I am. That's the first verbal expression of His Jehovah name. And then you have a really unusual one at the end of verse 14, I am. Essentially, I am blank. Which is one of the most incredible things, because sentence structure wise, you should have a subject, for a very simple sentence, a subject, a verb, and a predicate. You get a subject and a verb, but no predicate. It's left off. And as most of you here know very well, it's supposed to be left off or made blank. It's just, I am blank. And God is going to go through Israel's history and He's going to start filling in the blanks. In fact, it was to be a blank check for Israel, that they could just write in there whatever they wanted Him to be. I mean, how would you like that? God comes down and He says, by the way, you've got better than that right now. But God comes down and He says, what do you need? What do you need? Just fill in the blank. I'll be that for you. You need a fighter? I'll fight for you. You need somebody to bless you? I'll be your blesser. You need somebody to redeem you? I'll redeem you. Whatever you need, I'll do. Well, that I'm getting ahead of myself. The long form of it, I am that I am. In the Hebrew, it's interesting because it reads the same forwards and backwards. It's Hayah Asher Hayah. And Hayah is not a karate chop. Hayah! It's not Japanese, it's Hebrew. Hayah is a verb for the status quo of being. It means I exist that I exist. And then Asher is the relative particle, which is a normal relative, usually expressed with an antecedent, and the antecedent is the same word once again, Hayah, I am that I am. Now that's kind of the long or completed form of the verbalized expression of the Jehovah name. I am that I am. In giving Moses this verbal expression of his Jehovah name, he's doing this for multiple reasons, but he's actually developing a doctrinally expressive name or title or a designation. It's a doctrinally expressive one that he wants to be used in connection with himself, and he wants it to become a part of the children of Israel's vocabulary. He wants them to use this name, and he wants it to be understood and appreciated as being such by the children of Israel as a memorial forevermore. And so therefore it's a very that again just underscores how significant this name really is. And the first expression of this name, or the long form of this name, has some real consequences to it. Let's just take a look here. The short form. You just have the one Hebrew word, Hayah, I am. I am, fill in the blank. And it was Israel's blank check to be able to write in there whatever they wanted to be. Now he's going to come along and actually start filling those blanks in. If they won't, he will. And he'll do that to the tune of seven different Jehovah compound names, like Jehovah Rophekah, Jehovah Zidkenu, I will be your righteousness. Jehovah Rophekah, I will be the one who will provide for your redemption. Jehovah Shema, I'll be the one who is always there. Jehovah Shalom, I'll be your peace. and all of those. And by the way, as he does that, all seven of those Jehovah compound names are going to line themselves up perfectly with the seven feasts that Israel goes through in her calendar. And when all of those Jehovah compound names, as typified in all those feasts, come to their fulfillment, Israel will have perfect justification and perfect sanctification and be fit to be used by God to conquer the land when the remnant goes in there to take it with the Lord Jesus Christ at the end of the final installment of their program. Well, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's take a look at the issue of the two major principles that come out of these verbal expressions. When he comes along and he says, "I am that I am," one of the things that Israel had done, they had gotten, as I said, this mindset that since all this time had occurred and elapsed, and it's found in this kind of fleshly, sloppy thinking of theirs, that God had forgotten about his promise with them, and then they're just kind of left to their own now, and none of this is really going to happen. And this has been an issue and is an issue for a lot of folks all throughout God's Word. But really, the main issue of "I am that I am" is the issue of God's timelessness. When he says, "I am that I am," it's like, "I am that ever-present one." And time, past, present, future are the same to me. I don't have a problem with time whatsoever. And you get that. In fact, let me just give you one real quick example of that. Hold your place here and flip over real quickly to the 90th Psalm. We'll just look at the first couple of verses here, the 90th Psalm. When David extols that same period of time once again where Israel's looking for their king now to reign and be the king for them that they couldn't be. The opening of the fourth book of Psalms here in the 90th Psalm, you just have this. He says, "Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and world, even from everlasting to everlasting." There, "I am that I am." From everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And again, just flip back once again to Exodus 3, but what I'm after in just showing you that is God's eternalness. And that's something that you have to learn, and they had to learn about His Jehovah name. His Jehovah name, "I am that I am," is one of an eternal nature. And that's important. You have passages coming up. People do not make these connections the way they should make. I hear all the time today, people coming along and they're talking about how that we should be praying for people to get miraculously healed, and they come up and get whopped in the head and speak in tongues and that God, they even say that these TV evangelists and everything, they're going to raise the dead, they're going to heal your lumbago. They never have, like, I never see a faith healer in a VA hospital. You want to put these guys to the test, let's see them go in there. And instead of just making their acne go away, reproduce a limb, put it back on. They'll never do anything like that. It's always something that can be faked, and they are fakers. But you get this whole idea, and the underpinning for much of what they do. They want to slap some oil on you and get you healed and get you this and get you that, and apparently God can't do anything about male pattern baldness, and apparently God can't do anything about eyesight. It's funny to watch some of these faith healers when they go to read to put glasses on. Uh-oh. One of the most famous ones had a toupee. Why didn't he ever just say, "Yay"? I never did that, evidently. But and God can't apparently do anything for fat either, which that'd be me, Just divine liposuction. I'd like to trot up there sometime and say that, "Oh, preacher, I'm not here to, I don't have any problem. I just want you to take about 40 pounds off the middle, that's all. Go ahead." It'd take 4 or 5 of the catchers for me. But one of the things that they underpin all this, they run over to the passage, I won't turn to it, run over that passage in Hebrews 13:8, and they say, "Oh yes, this is God's miracle power, because Hebrews 13:8, Jesus Christ, the same today, yesterday, and forever." Yeah, I agree, he is. But that's connecting back with his Jehovah name. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That hasn't changed. The program is what's changed. God hasn't changed, but he has determined to change his program. He's not operating that way today. Could he? Yeah, he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's an expression in the New Testament of his Jehovah name, I am that I am. You get passages in 2 Peter chapter 3 where he talks about 1,000 years is a day and a day is a thousand. The timeless issue with God once again brought out. The very issues that you get brought up over there in the book of the Revelation, all the way down in the last book of the Bible, where Jesus Christ is viewed as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. That is an expression of his Jehovah name. I am that I am. And all the way to the book of the Revelation, that's an issue. Can time be an element in which God will be seen to not be able to do what he said he could do? Time is not a problem. And that may not be as critical in your thinking, but it is hugely critical in his program with Israel. And so therefore, coming out of that, really, it denotes several aspects of his Jehovahness, among which are two that I think you need to realize that are kind of subcategories of that. One of those is the nature of his immutability. When God says he is immutable, he cannot change. He's not going to change in his plan and what his program set out to do. And by the way, that's demonstrated in what he's doing right now in delivering them from Egypt. And from the Pharaoh, he's going to do that. He said he was going to do that. He said that all the way back in Genesis 3:15. And they should have been operating on that. It wasn't a lot of information, but it was enough information for them to be able to rest comfortably knowing that God told Abraham that he was not going to leave them in that horror of great darkness, but 400 years after the fourth generation, he was going to bring them out of all of that. And they had ceased functioning on that because they had again become skeptical of God's immutability. Well, he's changed his mind about the whole thing. But he hasn't. But the other issue that makes up that first long aspect of his Jehovah name, I am that I am, is the issue of the certainty of his counsel. That's why he brings up there in verse 12, he said, "Certainly I will be with thee." There's the when I say the certainty of his counsel, by counsel I mean what he has planned and purposed to do, what he's designed to do, is certain. And you can see the kernel of some things, or the core of some things that make up what saving faith is all about. But anyway, what I'm after is that there may be far more to it than that, but those are a couple of very important things about that denote the aspect of his Jehovah name that has to do with that first long expression, I am that I am, and the timelessness of all of that. And by the way, that theme is followed from Exodus all the way through God's Word. You also have the short version of that. When Christ comes onto this scene in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, how often he says, I am. He is the I am, and he is the embodiment in flesh of what Jehovah is all about. So the timelessness issue is one that is very important. And that's kind of a way of doctrinally oriented the nation of Israel to the issue of his faithfulness to actually deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians. And that's going to run from really the 10 plagues all the way through the Red Sea crossing. And we'll talk about that again in a moment. But before we get out of here this morning, let's get the other major principle that occurs in the shortened version of his name. I actually enjoy this one immensely because of the blank. I am. I am. I am. Blank. When you come to the second verbal expression, subject, verb, no predicate, that underscores, as the nation of Israel is going to have God function for them in ways they can't function for themselves, and fill the blanks in with everything that they need for Him to be that they can't do themselves, when they get into predicaments that they have gotten themselves into but can't get themselves out of, His Jehovah name, I am blank, that now comes into great importance and to the forefront. And what it's doing is, it's actually underscoring God's unlimited ability and His unlimited capacity to do everything for them they could not do for themselves. And this is something they will learn through a series of trials that form a secondary education for the nation of Israel into His Jehovah name. By the time Israel came to Mount Sinai, they had been thoroughly indoctrinated, taught, and educated in both aspects of that name. There wasn't a single Israelite who would come to Mount Sinai, had they learned what they were supposed to have learned, had it effectually worked in their inner man and effectually worked in their mind and in their heart, to that mountain at Mount Sinai and ever contemplated going under anything but this. We're going to stick with this. We needed things in the desert and we got them. We needed food. God says, I'll be your chef. Here's some food the angels eat. It was called, what is it? That's literally what the name manna means. Manna is a Hebrew word that means, what is it? Is that what, I don't know, I need Helen here. Is that what je ne sais quoi means in French? A certain je ne sais quoi, a certain I don't know what it is? It's kind of manna. I don't know what this is. God says angels eat it. I think it was like granola. I would have probably been one of the Israelites who would have said, you know, this would taste great with a great big thick layer of chocolate on it. But it was healthy. And I mean, it sustained them. It was exactly what they needed. They complained. They said they wanted meat. God said, all right, I'll be your hunter. And I'll go out and I'll find you some quail. And you're going to eat it till it comes out your nose. And it literally did. We need water, all right? I will be your well digger, and I'll get you water. We need a purified water, all right? I'll be your water purifier, and I'll get you pure water. And then they run up against Amalek. We need a general and a fighter, all right? I'll do all your fighting for you. All Moses has to do is hold his rod up in the air. I'll do all your fighting for you. We need to be able to handle the Gentiles. He said, I'll do that as well. I'll be your diplomat, and I will be your peacemaker. I'll do all of these things for you. You can't name something that you truly need that I won't be the one who can provide it for you. And in the face of all of that, they said, nope. We want to do it ourselves. So that's a tragedy. That's not a glorious thing going under the law. It was a tragedy. Well, anyway, the unlimited capacity aspect is very important, and again, runs down through even the gospel accounts. In John's gospel, when Christ says, I am the shepherd, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, I am the door, and he just pounds away on that, I am, I am, I am. All these fire, this should have been firing like, there's so many things. You realize that here comes my baseball illustration. When a pitcher throws a ball, you've got about 1/600th of a second to be able to figure out what that ball's doing. And if you're really good as a hitter, you can pick up the rotation of a ball. And actually, I don't know that he said that he could do it and actually prove that he could do it. Ted Williams said that he could see the ball hit the bat. And they said, oh, nobody can do that. Nobody can actually see the ball hit, make contact with the bat. He said, I'll prove to you I can. They took a bat and put shoe polish on it. And they threw to him, and he'd hit it, And as he'd hit it, he'd say, about a quarter inch under the seam. They'd retrieve the ball, and there'd be a mark right there. He'd hit it, and he said, I hit it right across the seam. Black mark right across the seam. That's how good his eyesight was. And what I'm saying, in a very short amount of time, you have to make a lot of connections in your mind of where the ball is, what it is, if it's a curveball, if it's a slider, if it's a knuckleball, if it's a fastball, all of these things, to make one decision, whether to swing or not to swing. When you hear Christ coming along, I am, I am, I am, I am, and all the things like that, what the way God's Word is designed is for you to be able to quickly make connections. You have to be able to make fire off those connections, and all of those should have been made back here. Those Israelites that heard him say that should have been making all these connections that just put on display the fact that is our Christ. Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah. He is the I Am. He is Jehovah in the flesh. He is all these things, and he's going to produce the biggest thing for us that we all need, our redemption. He's going to redeem us on Calvary's cross. And that's exactly what he did, as well as everything else they're ever going to need. Well, all I'm saying is that when we get into things like that, those are the kind of connections that need to be made in your Bible and in your mind as you're hearing these things and going through them. Well, as I said, this second Jehovah compound name is going to be utilized by God to fill in with all kinds of compound, or Jehovah name is going to get all these compounds put to them. I want to come back now to this particular slideshow, because I want to start going over something with you here in the final moments we got. All we're going to be able to do is kind of a preview of coming attractions here. I didn't have a way to go back and forth too well. I know I can put these links on here in PowerPoint where I can jump from one show to another and back, but last night when I was thinking about it, I thought, I have no idea where I'm going to be. So I can't plan that well. So you have to pardon my jumping from one show to another. Now, you've seen this chart before, I'm sure, but all it's showing is what we're going to have is the nation of Israel that got developed when God raised up Abraham. You have the four generations right there that he talked about. You got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then you have the generation of the 12 tribes that go down into Egypt. So this is the end of Genesis 50. And the famine hits the land, and the small band of them that were developed at that time, they go down into Egypt for that 400-year period of slavery and everything. Now what I want to do, and then again, all I'm going to be able to do is introduce this, but I want to hit on this because it's something that we've gone over before, but I want to put it together in a way that we haven't done it before. And I guess that's all I'm going to be able to do this morning, is kind of give you a preview of what we're going to do with this. Before we leave the Jehovah name issue, and especially deal with the issue of God's Jehovah-ness coming to Mount Sinai and all that kind of thing, because on our five major issues that we want to study out of the Exodus stage, God's teaching Israel his Jehovah name is one of them. But really, we've only gotten half that story. Because the thing that we really bore in on and focus our attention upon is what takes place from Genesis, or from Exodus 15 through 18. In other words, we look at, I can write on the board here, we really pay attention to this time frame right in here. After they come out of the Red Sea is Exodus 15. And then when they hit Mount Sinai here, that's the 19th chapter when they go under the law, or they begin to go under the law. And it's really right in between here that God does a major thing in teaching them about his Jehovah name. But there's two phases to this. And one of them we've really neglected a lot in the past, and I just want to bring it to your attention. We're not going to dwell on it a lot because there was a place in our studies of Romans that we actually looked at it. But before Israel, the Red Sea is the real marker, the line of demarcation. The reason why you have it's not the only reason. One of the main reasons why you have two verbal expressions, I am that I am, and that timeless issue, and his immutability, and his capacity to have certainty of his counsel. No matter what he says, he'll do. I mean, look at some of our politicians. Do you actually get in their reign what they promised in their campaign? Never. Never. Well, God, what he promises in his campaign, he makes good on in the actual reign. But the reason you got two phases in which he's going to teach them and educate them into what his Jehovah name means. And the first of these actually takes place in the 10 plagues. Now, a lot of people go through the 10 plagues and they think they're fascinating and you can make movies about them and all this kind of thing. But the truth of the matter is, the whole issue of I am that I am, the timeless issue, is actually taught all about God's faithfulness to the nation of Israel and his faithfulness to deliver them from the hands of the Egyptians. And that really goes through the 10 plagues to the Red Sea. That's what he does. And that's a fascinating aspect. Because as we will see, there's 10 plagues. And you'll go through, you've got the water turned to blood, you've got the frogs, you've got the lice. There's a good one. I remember when I was in grade school, remember when we all had to have our heads checked for lice? Mine was easy. Man, I had this burr haircut. There wasn't nothing living up there. And then the flies come in. The interesting word, murrain, M-U-R-R-A-I-N, the murrain of cattle. That's the Bible's expression for, that's an older English word for disease or a plague upon the cattle. Then you get the boils coming on them. The real spectacular one is that hail and fire mixture thing that comes down. Then the locusts follow that. Then the darkness. And finally, you have the death of the firstborn. Now, most people have no idea what... If God really wanted to display his power, why didn't he have one? Why go through 10? Why not cut to the chase and do the death of the firstborn thing first? Why go through 10? Well, there's a reason. He's not teaching about his I am blank that talks about his unlimited capacity and ability. He's teaching them about I am that I am. And there's a reason why, as you go through and you got to pay attention to those 10 plagues, there comes a point after the third plague, after the lice, God takes the land of Goshen, which was the part of Egypt. You hear people, I don't know if they still express that, land of Goshen. It's a good place to be if you were in Egypt and slavery during the 10 plagues, because during that time God took the land of Goshen, and for the next 9 plagues, or I'm sorry, the next 7 plagues, he's going to have all those plagues hit Egypt and the Egyptians, but not the Israelites in the land of Goshen. So when the flies come, they come everywhere. There wasn't a single fly in the land of Goshen. The disease of the cattle, all the cattle of the Egyptians got diseased, but not one of the cattle of Israel on the land of Goshen got diseased. And on it goes, the boils, the hailfire. Now the last one, of course, they had to apply the blood to the doorpost and the lintel, and the angel of death passed over them. But those 10 plagues are taught to be able to give Israel their initial basic education into God's Jehovah name, especially focusing upon I am that I am. And they flunked. They completely flunked. Because as I said, it takes you all the way to the Red Sea. What were they saying when they got to the Red Sea to Moses? Just paraphrase it. Anybody? Yeah. We're all going to die. You just brought us out here to die. They'd witnessed 10 amazing, miraculous plagues, 7 of which didn't even afflict them. Then they get to the Red Sea and they see the Egyptian army coming and say, "You're an idiot. Why did we follow you? You just led us out here to kill us. We'd rather die in Egypt than die out here." Hadn't learned. So they flunked that. So God immediately, but they worshiped. When they crossed the Red Sea, they got their tambourines out. They had a good old-fashioned Pentecostal revival praise and worship service. And the Bible even uses the W word. They worshiped. Well, it was a bunch of phoniness. Because no sooner had the song died down than God had to begin instructing them because of their whining and complaining. Only this time, He's going to teach them in phase 2 the issue of the short form of His name, I am blank. All right, if you wouldn't learn about I am that I am, my timelessness, my immutability, and my certainty of counsel, learn I am whatever you want me to be. It's another chance to teach and educate of His unlimited capacity, and that education and the indoctrination to that is taught to them in His fullness to be all they need for Him to be. In the 5 trials of education He takes them through that runs from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai. And that's really phase 2. Or from the land of Shur to Mount Sinai, they get 5 further trials of education. And they go through all 5 of those that God's going to fill in a blank of what His name means. But instead of learning it, after 2 phases of the most incredible education a human being could ever go through, when they come to Mount Sinai, this rotten attitude that they have had in their heart that has never gotten rooted out, God only, I'm not saying He was exasperated, but it's almost like that. He comes along and He says, "All right, the only other way, I've done everything I can. I've gone through all of this, and I've gone through all of this. Now, if you still won't understand what I want to do for you, and allow me to do for you what I want to do, there's only one alternative. You're going to have to do it yourself. Do you want that?" "Yeah! Hey, that's a great idea. Whatever you say, we'll do." And this is where we're going to pick it up next time. When they did that, and in Exodus 19, they said, "We will go under the law contract, we'll sign it, and whatever you say, we'll do." God intentionally, deliberately, and purposefully, when they got the law, it wasn't, "Oh, I'm coming off the mount with these wonderful laws. Isn't this great? Isn't this wonderful?" What God actually did, you'll see it come up here, watch it rise. He intentionally and deliberately put them under sin's dominion. If you won't learn by my grace and my Jehovahness how sinful you really are, and that in your heart the only thing that makes you different from any Gentile is me. It isn't because a little piece of flesh has been cut off or anything else. It's me. And they never did learn that they were sinners by nature. And they didn't learn that they were deserving of all those plagues. They didn't deserve for God to keep them from the flies or the diseased cattle or the boils or the hellfire, or the locusts or the darkness or death, because they be Abraham's seed. Abram didn't understand that. He understood exactly what God was. He was a friend of God. He understood that he deserved what all the other men of the earth deserved. And were it not for God Himself, he was nothing. They didn't understand that. So the only thing he could do is allow sin to teach them how sinful they were. That's what the law is. And we have pastors and scholars and Bible writers and Bible teachers to this very day who stand behind pulpits and defend living under the law. And they are purposely putting you under sin's dominion. And they so grossly misunderstand Romans 5, 6, 7, and 8 that it's unbelievable. I was telling Cecil at the break, I said, really, you know what a denomination is? It's a collection of people who have agreed to live under sin's dominion. That's what a denomination is. We're going to live under our brand of sin's dominion. And when we get enough of us together, we'll call ourselves a denomination so we can have lots of money doing it. Well, anyway, preview of coming attractions. We're not going to get into any of this in huge detail, but we're going to touch on these things. I do on Wednesday night. I want to make sure that we have a good appreciation for that first phase before we then go through in probably just a very survey-type way those five trials, because we've studied those things before, but I just want to bring them out again. But wow, do I have a better appreciation now for that first phase than I have ever had before. And that tells me why you've got two names here, not just because you've got two verbal expressions, but there are two phases and sides to that that God was trying to educate Israel in as they went through from the time that, really from chapter 3 through 19, through 18 anyway. All right, well, we'll stop it right there and we'll pick this up then and begin looking a little bit. We're going to look a little bit at phase one, a little bit at phase two. Then we'll go on to the second issue in those five major Exodus stage issues in Israel's program.